And Amanda Smith with you on ABC Radio National. This is Artworks, and a feature about contemporary theatre in Australia as a place for public discussion and debate. 40 years ago, new Australian plays by young writers like David Williamson, Alex Buzo and John Romerill were making a splash by commenting directly on the society and politics of their day. There's a fair bit of nostalgia around about that marvellous rise of Australian voices and stories in the theatre in the 1960s and 70s, which seemed to then fall away again. But over the last 5 years or so in Australia, there's been something of a revival of interest and a noticeable increase in plays that have a specifically political thrust to them. Is this because of new political sensitivities in Australia, or is it in response to global concerns about national security in a post-Cold War, post-9/11 world? Two of Australia's leading contemporary political playwrights, Michael Gurr and Melissa Reeves, are talking about their work in relation to these questions, as well as why they choose theatre as a platform for their ideas and stories. And throughout this feature, to demonstrate the craft of these two writers and to illustrate their political themes, you'll hear extracts from two of their plays. Michael Gurr's Crazy Brave, which is about a group of young anarchists disillusioned with today's politics who want to change the world through acts of public nuisance. Also Melissa Reeves' play The Spook, about the South Bendigo branch of the Communist Party of Australia and its apparent threat to national security at the height of the Cold War. First though, here's Michael Gurr.
I think it's harder to tell lies in the theatre. And I think this goes back to our very first memories of storytelling, which is to do with the contract of trust that a parent makes with a child, that you can tell a great big scary story, put on the voice of the monster, but you're still safe. And that's about the contract of trust. It goes right back there. There's an essential act of generosity at the heart of theatre. And it's the act of generosity that goes from the writer to the cast, from the cast to the audience, and from the audience back to the cast at the end. It's the form of writing that is most analogous to life, in that it's about people talking to each other with all the implicit mess that that implies.
I think I just fell in love with it quite early, and I think it's a wonderful medium. Theatre can be grotesque and baroque and heartbreaking, and as well as it can be super real. And, you know, I just think it's a really elastic, powerful, radical medium, and having people together in big groups to sort of, you know, group witness people acting, there's something very, very seductive about it, I think. The character of an audience can change from night to night, which, you know, I think probably would be not of much interest to the audience because they just go, we saw it and it was great or it wasn't. But if you're that intimately involved with it, it is like this sort of strange, intriguing, living being that sort of is in a different mood every night. And it is an exciting sort of place to work.
What do you do?
I'm talking to a journalist.
No, you're not.
What, you're not doing this?
I'm your husband!
I do some political stuff.
Yes.
I don't want to go into detail, just stuff.
Stuff?
Yes.
Okay. Don't tell me what you do. Tell me, though, instead, why you do it. What's your... You know, what's your aim?
We want to do something to help destroy the society that we live in.
We? So you're in some group?
The only place to be radical is from the centre. I don't think Australians are disinterested in politics, or uninterested, rather, in politics. I think Australians do a trick. They pretend not to be. What they do, or what we do, is we look in one direction, but we have an ear cocked. Very, very carefully. All the people that you ever meet who say, oh, I don't take any interest in politics, it's, you know, they're all the same. Ask them one question and you'll find that they're amazingly well informed. There are some subjects that you just have to address the facts, and your job becomes very, very specific. Organise them artfully in a way that is going to hold an audience for that time. With political theatre, you often run into this question with that you're preaching to the converted. This has always struck me as a lazy journalist's question, because even the converted needs sustenance. You need to attend these things so that you go back into the world armed better with good arguments to have amongst your family. And I think that's an important function for that sort of documentary theatre, this sort of, which has been around a lot in the world. You know, David Hare's done a bit of it. There's been a bit of it in America. There's been quite a bit of it here. It's a really good function.
Political theatre definitely does have that label of dull or whatever stuck to it. I just think it's an absolute myth. I also don't really much like the idea of sort of sugarcoating the pill so that everybody will swallow it. And I sort of think it's a very broad church, political theatre. I mean, you know, I would include a lot of playwrights and theatre makers who might not necessarily sort of categorise themselves as such as political. And there are also ones that are very, very hard-edged and consciously extremely political, and I think that's fantastic.
In putting together Something to Declare, I was given, three telephone books high worth of research. And it wasn't until I got this interview with Amal Hassan Basri that told us this incredibly, well, ordinary story about a woman who argued with her husband about the use of her car and then got on this boat and then all of this stuff happened to her. It wasn't until I got that I actually found the spine of it, and then all of the facts could sort of hang off that. I mean, it comes as it comes. I'm a great believer that for every single project, you get one lightning strike. And you have to respect that lightning strike and not mess with it too much, because if you mess with it too much, you end up with something that smells and looks like carpentry. In the case of Something to Declare, the lightning strike was Amal Hassan Basri's interview. Talking about Desire Lines, the AIDS play, I think I got it wrong. I tried to write an imaginative play and I should have written a documentary play. I thought my imagination was equal to the facts, and it wasn't. I'm a bit over plays that seem to be only about relationships, plays that don't open the window and allow the world to blow through and buffet the people around a little bit. It reminds me of those... again, David Hare said this thing he was talking about in some interview about Notting Hill, and he said, you know, These films in which people are nothing but their relationships, you know. And it reminds you of all those American films where you see, you know, the single woman being a bit depressed in her unbelievably expensive New York loft. And you know she's depressed because she's eating celery and listening to her answering machine. And you think, but you're a millionaire. And I always sit there thinking, but what do you do? What's your job? You know, the world must be allowed in.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be flippant. The point I'm making is this. The way I see it, people who devote their lives to justice, who fight for the kinds of things you've fought for, doesn't matter whether their own lives are pure and noble. I wonder if we put them under a harsher light. And when we put them under this harsher light, are we doing it because we can't stand hypocrisy? Or are we doing it because we'll do anything to destroy those people who tell us what's wrong with our world? I have a theory. We're never surprised when someone on the right is shown to be corrupt. It seems logical. Their whole philosophy is grab it while you can. But we scream like mad, and I reckon we scream with joy, when someone on the left is sprung for stealing the stationery. It somehow lets us off the hook, you see. I no longer have to think about justice or cruelty or whatever, because the people who force me to think about these things are just as petty as me. It's a kind of moral escape hatch. Am I making sense?
But I didn't steal the stationery.
No, I know.
An extract from Michael Gurr's play Crazy Brave, where the characters do much more radical things than not steal the stationery, like leaving dog poo at the stock exchange and throwing bags of vomit at museum openings. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. Amanda Smith with you, this week wondering where such actions get you, even if they are only in the world of theatre. Here's Michael Gurr again.
Crazy Brave came out of a sort of headache. In writing that play, I was interested in what happens to a revolutionary spirit in an essentially conservative country. Do they become mad, eccentric, marginalised, or it preempted all the terror stuff, but do they go there? And that was the question that sort of obsessed me with that play. The central role of Alice. She's someone who has an argument going on in her head all the time. She wants the world to be better and ends up hating the world as a result. Alana Valentine, a good colleague and friend of mine, said a great line, which I said when she said it, I said, I'm going to steal that, but I will always credit you with it. She said, every play must have an unsolvable question at its heart. I think it's the best playwriting advice I've ever heard. You know, theatre works when it addresses the irrational, when it addresses the unsolvable, the things that can't be quantified, where you agree with the last person who spoke, where you find your prejudices or preconceptions mucked up. That's where theatre works best. I was attracted to the idea of pointlessness, but driven by huge energy. You know, some people came out of seeing Crazy Brave and said, I'm really glad that woman's in prison. And some people came out weeping. I want both, because I think both things are true and I think it's possible to believe two things at once. Yes, that woman was a potential murderer, but she's also driven and forced by some sort of vision beyond what we've got. Like, she wants more. People who want more are always sort of attractive.
A packet of fertiliser, a wad of newspapers, some cotton wool and some diesel fuel. Do you want to know what these things can make? Lock picking, security cameras, ticket machines, ATMs. Shall we take another step? Potassium perchlorate, potassium nitrate. Phosphorus, mercury, toluene. The exploding mobile phone. How about changing a light bulb into a very big bang? You'll pick it up in no time. All we have to remember is that nothing is impossible. Absolutely nothing. There's always petrol and styrofoam. If you're feeling brave.
Oh, yes. I'm ready.
For me, work is visual. It usually starts with an image, which won't go away, and then I have to write my way towards it to explain how that happened. And my image for Crazy Brave was a woman who was almost relieved and grateful to be in prison. And I didn't know what that meant. And then I had to sort of work my way back and find out what that meant. I don't know if that's helpful, but it's visual. I don't start with a thesis. I think thesis plays always smell like thesis plays. When you see one, you sit down in the theatre and go, within the first 5 minutes, oh, spare me, I'd rather read the leaflet. As I say, theatre's about the messy things, the complicated, difficult, unanswerable stuff. So it doesn't have a... I'm talking about the inside plays now. There's no project. You just have to trust the lightning strike and go with it. Yeah.
Michael Gurr on what not to do when writing a political play. This is Artworks on ABC Radio National. Here's an extract from Melissa Reeve's play The Spook, which, as you'll hear, is all about spying.
Oh, Alex, I was so goddamn nervous that you'd just walk in and we'd be standing in the living room together, the spies and the commies all in the living room just looking at each other, the world blown into pieces, you know? Oh, man, what a trip. And somewhere in my head, I was going over what you said the other morning and I realised what you meant.
What?
You get it all first, don't you? Way before the papers. You could have told me. I wouldn't have told anybody. Honestly, Alex, you can trust me.
What are you talking about?
Russia invading Czechoslovakia.
No, I didn't know.
Well, you didn't?
No.
Oh.
Sorry.
But when you said there were things I didn't know...
That wasn't the things.
Oh. But...
Martin... I can't tell you.
No, that's all right. You know the party's come out very strongly against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I know.
So, what, you think they'll knuckle back under, or...?
Stop digging, Martin.
I wasn't.
It'd be putting my head on a block to tell you about it. I reckon only 2, maybe 3 people in Australia know. And I'm not one of them.
You know, before and during and since the play's been on, it's just been fascinating how spying has become of cultural interest again. You know, because when I was researching the play, I really enjoyed looking at how spying in the 60s had really permeated the whole culture, like all the spy games, you know, that I made a collection of sort of all the spy board games from the 60s, and so it did become, even though I was telling this historical story, its contemporary relevance was sort of was sitting there. ASIO is one thing, but the other huge part of the play is the Communist Party and the relationship between the Communist Party and ASIO, but also the relationship between the Communist Party and Australia and how big it had been post-war and how passionate and then through to the 60s it was sort of losing its power.
Have you ever heard of James Jesus Angleton?
No.
No, you wouldn't have.
Who is he?
He's the head of counter-espionage in the CIA.
What, you've met him?
I took him flying.
Yeah?
Yeah, I own a Piper Cherokee.
Wow.
He is the real thing, Martin. He runs spies around the world.
What was he doing in Australia?
You better be right that you don't open your mouth about this.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows this, no one.
Uh-huh.
I just know because I own a plane. And they wanted someone they could trust to fly them to Cooper Pedy.
Them?
Yeah, he came with a friend.
Who?
Jim called him Anatole. I don't know if that's his real name, but he's the most important defector that America's ever had. So high up in the KGB, a commander or something, gave them spies and counter-spies on plates. In 61, they were falling like ninepins.
Wow.
Yeah, they loved it here. They loved Australia. Jim said it reminded him of Mexico. Anyway, this guy, Anatole, he likes to talk. So does Jim. It's funny, eh? Well, maybe they thought they were miles away from anywhere. Maybe they just liked me. I don't know. But 1,000 miles above the little desert, they told me stuff that just blew my mind. And it's been burning a hole in my head ever since. Almost sent me crazy. They are so smart, the Russians. When Anatole defects, right, to the Americans, they check him out. They spend months talking to them because he's a big fish and they want to know if he's a genuine article. And he checks out. Everything he says checks out. And then he tells them that he was part of this fancy think tank, a sort of KGB inside the KGB, and that the KGB we know about is a sort of front, a fake. And there's a real KGB that's so hidden away that we've never heard of it until he arrives and tells them about it.
No, I definitely think something has shifted, but I still think the world's pretty deep in that sort of swing against an ideal of socialism. Like, I think it's quite frightening how commodity-driven and how enmeshed we are in capitalism, you know, and where we're going to go and how, you know, how the sort of death throes of the American empire are going to play out and what's going to happen in the Middle East. It was a sort of dawning resonance, a dawning realisation of the resonance of the story. And interestingly enough, when it got remounted at the Malthouse, the director, Tom Healy, said to me, "Look, I don't think the last scene's quite working." And, you know, and I sort of went, "Oh, no, OK. And, OK, I'll have a look." And even though it was sort of hard to just enter it again and go, now what should it be, what should it be? It was a really, really great thing to do because it sort of, I think I had more of that knowledge of the present because, you know, the world had moved on in the last 2 years. And so I wrote that last scene the second time with the knowledge firmly in my head going this, and I sort of was sort of writing more about the present than I was writing about, you know, the story.
Can I help you?
Mr. Tasakis?
Tasakis.
We're from the Department of Immigration. Can we come in?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have electricity here?
Sorry?
Electricity. Do you have electricity?
Yes, I have electricity.
I'd like to plug in my tape recorder and record our conversation.
Why do you want to tape it?
So we have a record of the interview.
Who are you exactly?
We're from the Department of Immigration, Mr. Tasakis.
From Melbourne? Yeah, I sent my forms to Melbourne.
Yeah, we got your forms.
Well, why have you come all this way to interview me?
You applied to be naturalised, Mr. Tasakis.
Surely you don't interview everybody.
Everybody has an interview, Mr. Tasakis.
It's Tasakis. I'm from Crete. It's Tasakis.
Are you willing to answer some questions?
I want to see identification.
You've got very good English, haven't you? Very good.
You want me to speak to you in Greek?
No, I just wondered why you speak English so well.
I speak 5 languages.
5? Oh, that's a lot, isn't it? Do you speak Russian? Is Russian one of them?
No, what is this? Have I committed a crime?
We're just asking you a few questions.
What is this? What is this?
Sit down, please.
I don't want to sit down.
Sit down.
No, I'm not going to sit down.
Sit down.
You can't mic me.
Mr. Tasakis, you're making this very hard.
I will stand over here and you can ask me your questions.
Why do you want to stand over there?
It's next to the window.
What's out the window?
There's nothing out the window.
Sit down, please. Sit down, please.
All right, all right. Now sit down.
Interview with Mr. George Tasakis.
What do you think of the Berlin Wall?
What?
The Berlin Wall. What do you think of it?
I've not seen it.
You think it's a good idea, a big wall like that?
I don't know.
Keep all the commies from running away?
I don't know.
If people try and cross over, they get shot and hang bleeding and squealing on the barbed wire. Do you like that idea?
Not particularly.
Do you think we should have a wall like that?
No. Where?
Around Australia.
Around the coast.
What do you think of that idea?
I think that's a stupid idea.
So you don't want a wall?
No.
What about a curtain?
You're wasting my time. I think maybe...
Sit down, Mr. Tasakis.
An extract from The Spook by Melissa Reeves, which you might have heard broadcast in full earlier this year on ABC Radio National in Airplay. This artworks feature produced by Robert DeYoung with playwrights Melissa Reeves and Michael Gurr. And earlier you also heard extracts from Michael Gurr's play Crazy Brave. I'm Amanda Smith, coming up to 11:30 now here on ABC Radio National. Next, it's movie time, and Julie Rigg will be revisiting Brideshead Revisited, the new feature film.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.